listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, go to www.nakedbibleblog.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 45, Acts 9. I'm your residential layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, how you doing?
Pretty good. How are you, Trey?
I'm doing good. So we got Acts 9 right now, I guess.
We do indeed.
Okay, looking forward to it.
All right, so let's just jump in with Acts chapter 9. I think we're going to do what we've been doing, you know, just sort of working our way through the passage. When we get toward the end here, there's going to be something that's a bit of a rabbit trail where I'm going to be reading a long excerpt of something. So I don't want to devote too much time to reading the whole chapter, but we'll see how it goes. So in Acts 9, we get the conversion of Saul, of course, who will become known as Paul. So let's just jump in here. We have, "But Saul, still breathing threats and murder against the disciples of the Lord, went to the high priest and asked him for letters to the synagogues at Damascus, so that if he found any belonging to the way, men or women, he might bring them bound to Jerusalem. Now, as he went on his way, he approached Damascus, and suddenly a light from heaven shone around him. And falling to the ground, he heard a voice saying to him, 'Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me?' And he said, 'Who are you, Lord?' And he said, 'I am Jesus, whom you are persecuting. But rise and enter the city, and you will be told what you are to do.' The men who were traveling with him stood speechless, hearing the voice, but seeing no one. Saul rose from the ground, and although his eyes were opened, he saw nothing. So they led him by the hand and brought him into Damascus. And for 3 days he was without sight and neither ate nor drank." Now, again, this is, we know the rest of the story. He gets knocked off his horse and so on and so forth. And, you know, he gets taken in by Ananias, and God speaks to Ananias. And, you know, out of this, you know, this is the conversion experience of Saul. He changes from one who persecuted the church to one who is going to be preaching Christ. Now, the first thing I want to sort of camp on a little bit is this issue of Damascus. Now, it was mentioned two times in what we read. In the very next verse, there was a disciple at Damascus named Ananias. You get another occurrence. But you've got three mentions of Damascus right here in this little portion of Scripture. And so, hopefully, you're already, you know, asking the question I've told you to ask before. When a place is named in the book of Acts, you might want to ask why. Now, there won't always be something revelatory behind it, but places have histories. And for the original recipients of the book of Acts, they're going to know something about Damascus. It's going to mean something to them because, again, places have histories, they have baggage and whatnot. So in the case of Damascus, Damascus is one of the oldest sites known to archaeologists in the Holy Land, and it has a long history in the Old Testament. It was the place where Abraham rescued his kinsmen, namely Lot in Genesis 14. David, you know, brought Damascus within Israelite control during his reign, but during the reign of Solomon, it was lost. Now, what's kind of interesting here is, think about it, you have, again, a reference to Damascus connected with Abraham, Genesis 14. Again, it's where he rescues Lot. He pursues Lot's captors that far, and then, you know, rescues Lot, brings him and his stuff back. And for some reason, David wanted it under Israelite control. Okay, wanted it to be part of the kingdom, wanted it to be part of, you know, his reign. Essentially, you know, is part of Israel, Yahweh's property. And then it's lost in Solomon's reign. Now, this gets us into actually a pretty complicated question. What exactly are the parameters of the promised land? Because if something is mentioned with Abraham connected to David, and then, of course, then Solomon, chances are it's going to mean something. And in this case, it does. Think about what God said to Abraham when he separated from Lot back in Genesis 13. In verse 17, we read, you know, God says to Abraham, "Arise, walk through the length and breadth of the land, for I will give it to you." Okay, so we have that little ditty there. If we go to Joshua chapter 1, we have sort of a reference to something like this. Joshua 1, we read, "After the death of Moses, the servant of the Lord said to Joshua, the son of Nun, Moses' assistant, "Moses, my servant, is dead. Now, therefore, rise, go over this Jordan, you and all this people, into the land I am giving to them, to the people of Israel. Every place that the sole of your foot will tread upon, I have given to you, just as I promised Moses." And, of course, the Mosaic promise goes back to this statement of Abraham. Because, remember, God calls Abraham, puts him in Canaan, says, this is the promised land. Then he says back in Genesis 13, hey, walk through the length and breadth of the land, because everywhere you walk, I mean, wherever you walk, that's what I'm giving to you. Well, it's not a coincidence that Abraham's feet, as it were, tread as far as Damascus. And so there's this sense that since Abraham was there, and it's within what in antiquity would have been thought of as Canaan proper, that the promised land, quote-unquote, includes, it goes as far north as Damascus. Now, the reality is, though, that the promised land is even, you know, farther north than that. If you actually looked at a map where some of these places are, Damascus is sort of just northeast of Mount Hermon. Okay, Mount Hermon, of course, very, very famous, very notorious. This is, again, just north of the region of Bashan, which, again, in my Divine Counsel stuff, I get into this geography a lot. Damascus is actually on the eastern side of the Jordan. If you just drew a line where the Jordan River goes north, off to the east, you're going to get Damascus. And it's actually a little bit north of Mount Hermon. So this is where Abraham winds up. And it takes the parameters of the promised land, in other words, what belongs to Yahweh, north to include, again, a notorious place like Bashan and Mount Hermon. Again, according to the Book of Enoch, this is where the Watchers descended, the Genesis 6, 1 through 4 story. And, of course, the region of Bashan was known as the last bastion of the Rephaim, the giant clans there with Og and Og of Bashan. And, you know, it takes you that far north, but it also gets into this stuff that's east of the Jordan River. There's actually it's not very easy to determine, because if you look at, you know, prophecy, people talking about, oh, the regathering of Israel and, you know, the founding of Israel in 1948, and this is a fulfillment of prophecy and all this kind of stuff. Hey, have you ever actually looked to see how the scriptures decide what the promised land is? You get like three different accountings, and this is part of that issue. Is Damascus in the original promise to Abraham? Is it included, even if it's not mentioned, in the original promise to Abraham or not? Again, since the original promise to Abraham goes as far north as the Hittite territory that was on along the coast, it goes as far north as Damascus, but it doesn't go, you know, easterly. And so there's this issue, well, is Damascus in or out? Is it part of the promise or not? Well, according to Genesis 13, God says, hey, look, wherever your foot treads, you know, just walk around here, wherever you walk, the length and the breadth of the land, I'm going to give it to you. And he says the same thing to Joshua, and he had said the same thing to Moses. So this becomes part of, again, an Old Testament outlook on what exactly is the promised land. And for our purposes in Acts, why would Damascus be mentioned? Well, it's mentioned because, again, this is a territory that doesn't specifically come up in Acts chapter 2, but the writer, again, wants you to know that this territory, this region, is, again, under the domain of Yahweh. And this is going to be actually the last place in this chapter. We're going to get a couple places. There's something that happens toward a little further on that's really, really complicated, really convoluted, and also, again, involves Nephilim territory. But Acts 9 is picking off the last parts of the land that are sort of outliers that were not specifically included in the narratives and from Acts 2 on the way up to this point, that have some history of occupation where it rightfully should be included in the land of the promise, but was under occupation by either suspect or hostile forces. And so before we get into the actual ministry of Paul, this is when Paul, you know, Saul gets converted to be Paul, before we actually transition out of this, take the gospel to the Jew first and then also to the Gentile, before we make that full transition, we're still picking up pieces of the land that the writer wants you to know were not overlooked. they're not either forgotten or it's not under a curse. It's not a spooky place. We don't want to touch that. There's none of that going on. Everything, even these places that have, you know, sort of an odd history or kind of a sinister history or a questionable history, as the one we'll hit in a few moments, even those places, again, God is making it clear, this is my domain. And now, again, after this chapter, after Acts chapter 9, we're going to start launching off into lands that are clearly, there's no dispute, clearly not included in the original land promises to Israel. But we're picking off a few of the outliers here. Again, it's about messaging. The message of the Messiah needs to go to the Jew first. Okay, we get that. We've seen that four or five times, you know, working our way up here in the book of Acts. It also includes, as we saw last time, proselytes to Judaism, weren't naturally born, but they converted. And here we're going to get a couple places that there's a question mark. Again, is this something we should view within the promise or not? Well, again, the answer becomes yes if we allow Acts chapter 9 to sort of be a commentary on some of the Old Testament controversial places where there's ambiguity, or there's not, you know, absolute clarity on is it in the promise or not. Again, if you're looking at Acts 9 as sort of a commentary or a filter looking back into the Old Testament, the answer would be clear here, because we have to sort of absorb these places. We have to answer this question, because the gospel needs to be taken to the Jew first, their territory, their people, even people who converted to Judaism that weren't ethnically Jewish. We've got to cover all those bases, and then in Acts chapter 10, we can jump off into it territory that is clearly, again, clearly Gentile material. So I wanted to say, again, make another comment about that, because you have, again, theological messaging in some of these sort of innocuous kind of details. Let's jump back into Acts 9 here, verse 10 we'll pick up. There was a disciple at Damascus named Ananias, and the Lord said to him in a vision, Ananias, and he said, here am I, Lord. Again, that's very formulaic language for the calling of prophets, the calling of someone who's going to speak for God. That's all a prophet is, a spokesperson for God. And that role fits Ananias, because Ananias is going to testify to the validity of Saul's conversion, and also to the validity of what God told him and what God told Saul. So he's going to be sort of a mediating figure between Saul, who will be Paul, and people who are, you know, freaked out by this, very naturally. So verse 11, the Lord said to him, rise and go to the street called Straight, and at the house of Judas, isn't that ironic, look for a man of Tarsus named Saul. For behold, he is praying, and he has seen in a vision a man named Ananias come in and lay hands on him so that he might regain his sight. But Ananias answered, Lord, I've heard about this man, how much evil he has done to your saints at Jerusalem. And here he has authority from the chief priest to bind all who call on your name. And, you know, we get into this, it's not an argument, but, you know, Ananias is disturbed, you know, by what God has asked him to do, what the Lord's asked him to do. And he has good reason. But the Lord, you know, convinces him and says, look, I know all that. This guy is the chosen instrument of mine to carry my name before the Gentiles and kings and the children of Israel. Now, you know, you need to go talk to him. And he does it. I want to park a little bit here on this one line, a little phrase here in verse 13. Ananias answered, Lord, I've heard about this man, how much evil he has done to your saints at Jerusalem. Now, I'll admit, this is sort of a pet peeve of mine. I really dislike English translations that translate Greek hagioi, that's what we have here, as saints. And it's not because I'm anti-Catholic. I wasn't a Catholic in my youth. I don't have any problem, you know, as far as, you know, just this point of irritation because of Catholicism. My point of irritation here is that a translation like saints mars important biblical, theological imagery and analogy to the Old Testament. What hagioi literally means is holy ones, okay? And if you look back into the Old Testament, you say, well, why would Christians be called holy ones? All right, try to throw saints out of your head. It's a really unfortunate translation, because again, it's going to interfere with what I'm going to get into now. But why would Christians be called holy ones? Well, one of the first questions you should ask yourself is, does that phrase, you know, holy ones, you know, however that is in Hebrew, it's kedoshim in Hebrew, does that ever show up in the Old Testament? Well, of course it does. This term, holy ones, is used of both divine beings, members of the divine council, and human beings. As far as examples where holy ones refers to divine beings and the divine council, you get Deuteronomy 33, 2 and 3. That's the scene at Sinai. Yahweh is there with his holy ones. We get Job chapter 5, verse 1, where, again, one of Job's friends says, "Hey, is there anyone who will answer you, Job? To which of the holy ones will you turn?" And that introduces the idea of divine counsel, mediation of some sort between humans and God. Of course, in that context, it's Job. Job 15:15, God puts no trust in his holy ones. Again, he knows they have free will. He knows they can choose to do wrong. Again, there's a whole track record of that in the Old Testament. Psalm 89, verses 5 and 7. Again, let the heavens praise your wonders, O Lord, your faithfulness in the assembly of the holy ones. In Daniel chapter 4, 17, we get two terms, that are going to be familiar to this audience. The divine being speaking to Daniel, in this vision, says the sentence, again, that's been described in Daniel chapter 4, which concerns Nebuchadnezzar's madness. The sentence is by decree of the watchers. The decision by the word of the holy ones. Now, that's actually an important reference, because if you look at Daniel 4, think about what it's saying. The sentence is by the decree of the watchers. The decision by the word of the holy ones, plural. And then the rest of the verse says, to the end that the living may know that the Most High, that's singular, there's only one of those, that the Most High rules the kingdom of men and gives it to whom he will and sets over it the lowliest of men. We have this sense, again, of the holy ones, members of the divine council, participating in divine decision-making of things that happen on earth. Last reference would be Zechariah 14:5, when Yahweh at the last day, the end of days, the day of the Lord, comes back to earth with his holy ones, again, to judge the wicked. So there's some very clear examples where holy ones refers to members of the divine council. That's the whole point. There are also instances, and these are a little more obscure, where holy ones, plural, refers to people, human beings. Leviticus 11, 44 through 45. Now, this one would not sort of jump out at you, and it's going to sound familiar, but just bear with me here. Leviticus 11, 44 says, "For I am the Lord your God. Consecrate yourselves, therefore, and be holy, for I am holy." Now, the tricky part about this is the "be holy," again, I'm reading the ESV, in the ESV translation, the word "holy" is actually plural. It's kedoshim, just like these other references. So the more accurate translation, and the verb form is also plural, the more accurate translation would be holy ones, for I am holy. Again, he's speaking to the believing community of God, or at least the elect community, the Israelites. And again, if you've done any, if you followed any of my research in the Divine Council, the whole point with the restoration of the kingdom, Israel, the people of God on earth post-Eden, is to revive or kickstart, again, the Edenic idea where God rules among people on earth, right there with them. And then we have to sort of, turn our little spot on earth that is where the divine presence dwells. We have to expand that through the whole earth. That's the original Edenic commission, to be fruitful and multiply, and then, overspread the earth and subdue it, have dominion over it. Again, turn the earth into Eden was the original command. Well, when we kickstart the kingdom again through bringing the people out of Egypt, the Exodus, and here we are at Sinai, and then God turns around and said, "Hey, be holy ones, for I am holy." There's a little bit of flavoring that goes on in that, because the ultimate plan is to have it for, God wants a family of human beings with him. This is why the plurals in Genesis 1. Again, I can't repeat the videos that I've done on the whole divine council worldview, but the Edenic plan was that God would have a human family along with his unseen divine family, living together, ruling together on his behalf, one big, unified family, with the goal that humanity would at some point be glorified. Again, if they hadn't fallen, since we did fall, we look forward to that, to being redeemed finally, the consummation of the whole plan of salvation as being glorified and made like him. Like 1 John 3 says, we will be like him. We'll be more than human, that sort of thing. Well, that kind of imagery, that kind of thinking, the restoration of the divine presence on earth with the kingdom, with a people, is designed specifically to go back to Eden, kickstart Eden, and have it work this time. Because God has forgiven humanity, he's provided a means of salvation. He didn't destroy them like the Nakash, the serpent, had assumed he would. That doesn't happen. We have the reinstitution of God's family, and his family means also his council on earth through human beings. So if we were translating these terms holy ones, you'd sort of pick up on that idea because of the way holy ones is used of divine beings. Here's another example, Daniel 8:24. We have a reference here, or again, a use of the plural here. His power shall be great, but not by his own power. He shall cause fearful destruction and shall succeed in what he does and destroy mighty men and the people who are the holy ones. Again, this is a reference to, a great earthly enemy of God, sort of an antichrist figure. But the object of what is happening there are the holy ones. Again, ESV translates it saints. Again, this is just my hobby horse. It just ruins the imagery. Psalm 34:9, oh, fear the Lord, you his holy ones. Okay, there are references, very same word, same terminology used of humans and divine beings. That is not accidental. We're supposed to be thinking of believers, of people who are faithful to Yahweh. We're supposed to be thinking about them the way we think about the divine beings in his council, because they're six of one and half a dozen of another. The only difference between them is, again, the fact that the human beings are not on the other side. They are not in the spiritual world. They are not glorified, and earth has not been remade into Eden. That is eschatological stuff, since we have the problem of sin, since there's been this thing called the fall. But we're still supposed to be thinking about both groups in the same way. And so in both testaments, when I see the translation saints, I just, you know, honestly, I haven't done it, but I just want to scream. You know, in church, I just kind of roll my eyes. It's like, you know, look at what you're missing just by this simple translation. If you literalized it, you would see connections back into the Old Testament in both these arenas. I want to take this a little bit further. Again, we saw a passage, Daniel 4, about the holy ones participating, the divine council participating in decision-making. Let me just introduce you to a couple passages. You can go study them. You can think about them because they could go either way. So I'm being honest with you here. There's a little bit of ambiguity in the text. But there are a couple disputed passages whether kedoshim, a plural of the word kadosh, whether it should be translated and understood as plural or as singular. And you say, well, that's kind of an odd question to even raise. Well, think of it like Elohim. Elohim is morphologically plural, but in many contexts, it means a singular entity, the God of Israel. Sometimes this happens with kedoshim as well. You don't know whether it's talking about the Holy One, God, or Holy Ones, plural. Okay, here's a couple verses. Proverbs 9:10. Says, again in the ESV, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and the knowledge of the Holy One is insight. Believe it or not, Holy One there is plural. You could translate it, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and the knowledge of the Holy Ones is insight. Again, it sort of gives a little street cred, you know, a little, I guess, heavenly cred to the divine council there, you know, if it indeed is meant to be understood as a plural. Proverbs 30, verse 3, same thing, says, I have not learned wisdom, nor have I knowledge of the Holy One. It's plural. You could translate it, I have not learned wisdom, nor have I knowledge of the Holy Ones. Now, the reason why these two plural references could be singular, and that's the way the ESV has both of them, if you notice the translation, is this next verse, Hosea 11:12, which in the Hebrew text, if you're looking at this in Hebrew, if any of you know Hebrew, it's going to be actually a different verse reference. It's chapter 12, verse 1. But in English Bibles, it's Hosea 11:12, says this, Ephraim has surrounded me with lies, and the house of Israel with deceit, but Judah still walks with God and is faithful to the Holy One, or is it Holy Ones? Well, because of the parallelism there, walks with God, faithful to the Holy Ones, it's probably better to see that as singular, walks with God, faithful to the Holy One. It just makes sense. But the fact is, in those other two verses, it sort of could go either way, but you can make an argument based on Hosea 11:12 that those two other verses should be singular as well. So you can chew over that, think about that, do with it what you want. And we're going to go back to Acts chapter 9. I want to skip down to about verse 20. When we get here in Acts chapter 9, I need to flip back there in my Bible in a second. There we are. So Ananias, again, takes care of Paul, or Saul. And we read in verse 20, or at the end of verse 19, "For some days he," that is Saul, "was with the disciples at Damascus. And immediately he proclaimed Jesus in the synagogues, saying, 'He is the Son of God.' And all who heard him were amazed and said, 'Isn't this the man who made havoc in Jerusalem of those who called upon this name? And has he not come here for this purpose, to bring them bound before the chief priests?'" Well, the answer to all that is, yeah, that's the same guy. "But Saul," verse 22, "increased all the more in strength and confounded the Jews who lived in Damascus by proving that Jesus was the Christ." Now, I want to take two phrases here. Son of God, he is the Son of God. And then this notion of proving that Jesus was the Christ. Now, I'm just going to make a comment because you can go back and listen to previous episodes. Remember when we talked about the word Mashiach, the word Messiah, and the word Christos. Okay, these are titles. And with the overwhelming New Testament use of the title Christos, which is just the Greek form of Messiah, all right, Mashiach, it was always associated with one or two things, a handful of key ideas, and one of which was, again, the death, burial, and especially the resurrection, okay, of Jesus. So when New Testament writers are talking about the Christ, they're talking about the full-orb gospel. You say, well, why are you bringing it up? Well, if we can see in verse 22, proving that Jesus was the Christ, again, obviously used as a title there, he is the Messiah, I mean, the eschatological Messiah, the ultimate Messiah, the capital M Messiah. This guy was the capital M Messiah. Then in verse 20, when it says that Paul was persuading them that Jesus was the Son of God, the phrase Son of God there, therefore, because of Jesus was the Christ, two verses later, the phrase Son of God in verse 20 has to mean more than just the royal king figure from the line of David. Now, what I mean here is that if you look in the Old Testament, the phrase Son of God referred to, it's used of Israel as a nation, that's Exodus 4:22, and it's also used of the king of Israel, 2 Samuel 7, verse 14, Psalm 89, verses 26 and 27, God refers to the king as my son. So there would be those interpreters that say, look, this is all that Paul's talking about. Paul believes that Jesus was of the line of David, he's descended from David. You know, Paul isn't loading any of this theological stuff on the title Son of God. He's not talking about, like, the capital M Messiah here. Jesus is just a descendant of David, and that's where we draw the line. That's all Paul's talking about. All this resurrection stuff, you know, comes later, and, the Christians invented that later, and it got imported by scribes back into the New Testament. This is the Bart Ehrman kind of thinking. Okay, that is just bunk. Okay, because of the way Christos, again, two verses later, has been, front-loaded with all of these references, as we saw earlier in our study of Acts, all of the baggage that associates that title with a divine being, a resurrected being, a glorified being who now sits at the right hand of God and fulfills this great eschatological role in conjunction with the coming of the Spirit, these promises that were given in the Old Testament about, again, the Spirit of God coming, forgiveness, that whole thing, reclaiming the nations, which is a heavy, eschatological messianic theme. Again, recovering, bringing the nations back into the fold, that sort of thing. That was not just in the days of the Israelite kings, prior to the exile. That kind of talk is associated with the coming of the kingdom of God, the real kingdom of God, the big one, okay, the one that includes everything, the one that includes all the nations. So because, again, of this backdrop of the way Christos was thought of and the way it's used by New Testament writers, we need to look at Son of God in its fullness and not just restrict it to, oh, he came from the David's line, that's it. Again, that just doesn't work here. So I wanted to make that comment as well. And lastly, again, in this chapter, something to notice here. If we go down, I'll go down a little ways in verse 23. When many days had passed, the Jews plotted to kill him, kill Saul. But their plot became known to Saul. They were watching the gates day and night in order to kill him. But his disciples took him by night and led him down through an opening in the wall, blowing in a basket. So Saul gets away. He goes to Jerusalem, verse 26. When he had come to Jerusalem, he attempted to join the disciples. My paraphrase, they were all freaked out by that. They didn't believe he was really a disciple. But Barnabas, another character, who we've seen earlier, again, from Cyprus, again, one of these places that isn't mentioned in Acts 2. Again, the writer's creating a web. All these things are related. Okay, everybody's on the same team kind of thing. It all goes back to Acts 2. It all goes back to the coming of the Spirit. It's all the fulfillment of the Old Testament. Okay, so Barnabas shows up again in the narrative, took him, brought him to the apostles and declared to them, you know, chill out. He says, look, you know, this is what happened to him. He was on the road. He saw the Lord. He spoke to him at Damascus. He preached boldly in the name of Jesus. You need to embrace him and accept him. And they do. They do. So when we get down now to verse 32, we transition to Peter. Okay. Peter's soon going to be out of the picture in the book of Acts. It's going to be sort of Paul on stage for most of the rest of the book after once you get out of chapter 10 and 11 and whatnot. But now we hit Peter in verse 32, and it says, now as Peter went here, the earlier verse talked about Judea and Galilee and Samaria and all that stuff. So as Peter went here and there among them all, yeah, he's visiting, you know, people who've come to the Lord. He came down also to the saints. There it is again. He came down also to the holy ones who lived at Lydda. And there he found a man named Aeneas, bedridden for 8 years, who was paralyzed. Peter said to him, Aeneas, Jesus Christ heals you. Rise and make your bed. And immediately he rose, and all the residents of Lydda and Sharon saw him, and they turned to the Lord. Again, what you already know what question I'm going to ask. Why Lydda? What's the big deal? What's up with that place? Again, Lydda is just northeast of a town that we've seen already called Azotus. Again, which had, again, that was the Hellenistic name, again, for one of the Philistine cities. And so we talked about how here's another part of the land, another little strip of land that was under Philistine control. And again, the narrator brings it in here to make us realize that, okay, even though this was a place that has baggage, it was associated with the Rephaim, who were the Nephilim descendants and all this stuff. These people too, that the gospel's going here and it's working. Okay, Jesus has power over this place. They are being brought into the kingdom of God. So Lydda, or Lod, as it's called in the Old Testament, is near this place. It's not the same place. It's just adjacent. Now, what, again, to try to summarize, you know, some of this in kind of quick fashion here, what you have going on here, if you look up the four occurrences of the word Lod in the Hebrew Bible, L-O-D, you're going to find that it has, it's a bit of an unusual history. You're going to find it in 1 Chronicles chapter 8, verse 12. That's probably the most important reference. And so I'm just going to go there quickly and I'll read it to you. It's not going to sound like anything important, but it is in the genealogy of the Benjamites, okay, King Saul. This was his tribe back in the Old Testament. And that's 1 Chronicles 8. You know, the first nine chapters of 1 Chronicles is nothing but genealogy, all right? So we're right in the middle of that, or right toward the end of it anyway, and we get to verse 12, and it says, it's just listing, the sons of El-Pa'al, Eber, Misham, and Shemed, who built Ono and Lod with its towns. You say, who gives a rip? Who cares? Big deal. This is a genealogy of Benjamin. The city of Lod does not fall within Benjamite territory in the Old Testament. It, therefore, again, there's a question of, well, what what is this place? I mean, whose territory really is it? And why are Benjamites living in it after the exile, which is when you get First Chronicles? Why did they go back there? Why did they live in it? And if it's not really in their territory, well, whose territory is it in? Okay, you'll find from references in Joshua when the allotments are given. Again, I'm summarizing a lot of pretty convoluted, complex stuff. You'll find that Lod was either, again, you can't be completely certain because of the where the tribes overlap, the tribal boundaries overlap, and Lod is or isn't mentioned, but it's assumed again. You'll find that it's either in the tribal allotment to what would have been Samaria, okay, Shimon, that area up there. And we've already talked about Samaria before, how that was the northern kingdom that apostatized and whatnot. Or, and here's where I lean, or it's in the territory that winds up being in the place where the people from the tribe of Dan lived. Now, Dan, for those of you who don't know, is one of these Old Testament mysteries. And it's because of numerous conflicting things said about Dan in the Old Testament. Usually, I'll just give you a few instances. Usually, when you get a place or a person, in this case Dan, a tribal name in a genealogy, they tend to be listed in the same numerical order or the same place. There's a little bit of variation, but it's usually pretty consistent. Dan is never consistent. It can be second, it can be fourth, it can be sixth, it can be 10th, it can be 12th. It's just all over the place. So that has really sort of raised eyebrows among scholars. Like, why does it keep changing positions? And sometimes it's not even mentioned. It's actually skipped. If you actually look and go through, and I don't recommend it unless you're looking for a way to cure insomnia, but if you look through, read through 1 Chronicles 1 through 9, you don't get a treatment of the genealogy of Dan. You know, I've dropped a few hints before I think at least in one other episode, and definitely if you've read a few things either in my myth draft or even in my novels, the latest one, there's a suspicion that's cast over the tribe of Dan. The tribe of Dan originally was allotted territory near Benjamin, but they left. Okay, the people of the tribe of Dan were ones that were mentioned in the book of Judges as having failed to drive out the giants, the Anakim, okay? And they just didn't do the job. And so they got in a bad situation, again, summarizing a lot of the details, and they decided eventually to move north. The tribe migrated. If you remember in the book of Judges, this is when you get the weird story about the Danites and the Levite, who had the, sort of an idol with him. And they kidnapped this guy and he was going to be their priest. And they move up north and they take the city of Laish and they rename it Dan. Of course, later in Dan's history, what happens? It becomes a cult center to Baal. it's right there, nestled, next to Mount Hermon. Okay, you get all these bad associations with Dan because they forsook their inheritance. They migrate north. And again, they wind up, in these northern parts. Well, it could be, again, because of this migration, that this place named Lod here that shows up in Acts chapter 9, Lydda or Lod, is in Danite territory. Again, it's right on the boundary. So, well, what's the point? What's the theological messaging? Okay, well, think about it. You have a tribe that has a bad history. It's a questionable history. They did not drive out the giant clans. Their original territory, in fact, some of it gets taken over by the giant clans. They move north and they're idolaters. Okay? The place becomes a cult center to Baal. It's in the region of Bashan, right up there next to, again, Mount Hermon. This is the territory of the Rephaim, the bad guys, more giant clans in the Old Testament. There's just a shadow, a sinister shadow over the tribe of Dan. The whole prophecy thing in the book of Revelation about the 144,000, if you actually go read, I think it's Revelation chapter 4 where the 144,000 are listed, guess which tribe is not there? Dan. It's omitted. Why? All of this stuff, cumulatively, even during the Second Temple period before we had Christians, but certainly after the rise of Christianity, the tribe of Dan became intertwined because they settled in the region of the serpent, Bashan. It became part of Antichrist teaching, Antichrist speculation. that the tribe of Dan had something to do with a great enemy that would rise in the north that would be associated with this really icky stuff like Mount Hermon, the Watchers, the Nephilim, all this kind of stuff. Dan just had a shadow over it. And so here in the book of Acts, before we hit chapter 10, when Peter's going to have his vision about taking the gospel to the Gentiles, and then Paul's going to do that, this last scrap of land in Canaan, in the Holy Land, that the writer wants us to be sure that the gospel has power over this place is, guess what? It's Lydda, it's Lod, and it attaches itself to the region of Dan, to the tribe of Dan. So they're not getting skipped either, is the point. They are part of this reclamation process. The gospel has power in that place too, despite all the baggage, despite all the spooky stuff that is associated with that region. Okay, the gospel has power there. Because if you go back and look at what happens with Aeneas. In this place, Peter finds a man named Aeneas, bedridden for 8 years. He's paralyzed. Peter says, "Rise and make your bed." And immediately he rose. And the last line here, and all the residents of Lydda and Sharon, which is the plain right next to it, geographical plain next to it, saw him, and they turned to the Lord. The next part of the chapter is Joppa, the story of Dorcas, Tabitha. We know that story a little bit more. It's in the same, again, region. Joppa, Azotus, Lod, all these places that have, again, sinister associations. The point is that the Spirit has power in those places to the same degree and for the same reasons and with the same thoroughness as anywhere else. It doesn't matter what cosmic geographical associations have accrued to a place. It's all the Lord's. It will be reclaimed. Again, going back to Matthew 16, the gates of hell will not be able to prevail against the church, against the gospel. And these are living illustrations, again, imbibing, again, within into the cosmic geographical thinking of the time. They're living illustrations that this is serious. This plan is serious. Nothing is going to be omitted and overlooked. It's all going to be put under the authority of the king. It's all under the power of God. So again, I know that was a little scattershot for Acts chapter 9, but I wanted to highlight some of the things that usually get overlooked, again, that feed into this thing that I call the divine counsel worldview of Scripture.
No, that's a content-filled episode right there. That was great. That's amazing how just a little translation of the saints takes a whole nother imagery. It's just amazing.
I mean, if you're hearing that, and again, if you know the Genesis stories, if you know, again, this whole concept of God and the divine counsel, the heavenly host, and especially what Genesis was, I mean, it's temple building. I mean, Eden is God's living place. It's his living room. I mean, it's where he lives. It's where he conducts business. Okay, the council's there. Adam and Eve are there. We're supposed to be there. Okay, we are supposed to be there. And we know why we're not. And again, just that much of an observation raises the question, well, how do we fix that problem? And again, that's the book of Acts. Well, we'll tell you how you fix that problem. It's this man Jesus who, by the way, you guys put to death, but it's okay. He rose again. He's offering forgiveness. The whole plan of salvation is right there.
That's another reason why we need a Heiser translated Bible. We'll be waiting for that to come out.
You'll be waiting a long time for that to come.
And even that, the whole tribe of Dan, that sure would make a great story in a novel.
Yeah, it would. Right. We'll see what we can do with that. That one will happen before that'll happen before the translation, let me tell you.
Okay, well, great. Well, next week, I think we're going to do a question and answer show. We've got several questions, so if you have another question, please send them in.
Yep. What do we have, like 7 or 8 questions? Oh, it's more than last
time. Yeah, we've got more than that. We had a good showing of questions. So I appreciate everybody that sent in the question. And also, Mike, you've got a project you'd like to talk about, GoFundMe.
Yeah.
What'd you tell us about that?
Yeah, we launched that, what is it, 4 or 5 days ago. Trying to raise money for the completion of what I call my Divine Counsel bibliography. You could go up to my website, drmsh.com, and you get past the scrolling pictures there, go down into the posts, and you'll see a post about completing the Divine Counsel bibliography through GoFundMe. And in a nutshell, I've been working on this thing for, 7-8 years. It began with my dissertation bibliography and the bibliography of a friend of mine who did a Divine Counsel dissertation. And I put those things together, and then I just started collecting references and PDF files, peer-reviewed stuff that to go with the bibliography whenever I could find it, and put all that together. But it's a putter project. It's just, I've been at it 7 or 8 years trying to put it online and get all the bibliographic information correct and whatnot. And it's just something that needs to get to the finish line. I mean, if in Heiser years, this is probably another 5 years away. I figure it's about 300 hours of work, which, isn't that, 8 weeks, if somebody was doing it full time, that sort of thing. So it's not a huge amount of work, even though it sounds a lot. It's easy work, but it's just tedious. And it's one of those things that I never seem to get time to do, 5 minutes here, 10 minutes there. And I'm just kind of tired of it hanging around. So I thought, hey, why not try to raise the money? It's not for me. The money that we're trying to raise is so that I can pay someone to get this project done. Hopefully by the end of the year. That's sort of my mental goal, to be able to have this thing in the can by the end of the year. And people can donate in any amount, but if you donate $50 or more, I'm going to give complete, world without end, lifetime access to this thing with the PDFs included. So it'd be great if you're doing your own personal research, or you just want access to a vast collection of this stuff. On paper, this thing is about 230, 240 pages long, this bibliography. And it's about 3/4 of what it should be. So this is a massive bibliography related to all things Divine Counsel. Everything that's touched on in the Myth Book, my upcoming book, Unseen Realm, this is the pool from which, I draw in terms of research. And there is literally nothing like it on the planet. So that's what we're trying to get finished.
Wow, that sounds like such a valuable resource.
Yeah, it'll be valuable for me and other people who want access to it. Again, it's a bit of an experiment, to try to do it this way, but it's just taken so long that I want to get it done.
And so for $50 in GoFundMe, people will get lifetime access to this resource?
Yep. I'll give you the password, same one I use. It lives on Zotero right now, but it's not public. It's just my private account. So once it's done, I'll just give people the URL and the password. They can go in and look around, sort things, download the bibliography itself in terms of what's in it. And if there's a PDF file attached to, one of the articles, you'll get that too. If you want it, it's up to you.
That's great. Well, I encourage everybody to go to GoFundMe.com/Divine Counsel and contribute. Mike, is there anything else you would like to discuss?
Yeah, I leave tomorrow morning to do a TV interview. I just posted something on the blog before we did the show here. This is for Gaiam TV, which is the streaming TV show counterpart to Coast to Coast AM. They called me, I guess it was about a week ago, and wanted me to go out. It's in Denver, so they're going to fly me out to Denver. I'm more or less just in and out. They put me up in a hotel. They come and get me. We go do the show with George Norrie, same host as Coast to Coast AM, and then I'm out again, Monday morning. But some of you might be wondering, Mike, I thought you hate doing TV. You're correct, I do hate doing TV, but I have a long history with Coast to Coast, and I want to continue to have that relationship, and I think I can trust them. Is really why I said yes. I've posted before about the hack job that the History Channel did to me in 2003. And I actually related that to the producer of this particular show that I'll be filming. And he was, to put it mildly, appalled. And again, given our history with me and the people who are involved in this, and some of them are the same as with the radio show, I feel very confident that they're not going to pull anything fast. The topic is, believe it or not, biblical astral prophecy. So if you have read The Portent, you know what we're talking about on this show. If you haven't read The Portent, well, shame on you. Once this goes live, I think they said it takes a week or two for an episode to actually air, to actually stream. I'll post something on the website so you can go hear the interview. But to really sort of get the full picture and, again, set it in a story, right, I have a little more freedom to speculate. You should read The Portent. But there's going to be a high degree of continuity between that content and what I do this weekend.
Awesome. Great. Well, I'm certainly looking forward to that.
Oh, and I should mention one other thing. My family got a pug last week. And those of you who follow on Facebook, you've probably seen pictures of this pug. So I just want to pass on. Yeah, it's working out pretty well. I've said before publicly that every scholar should have a pug to put on his lap while he writes. Well, now I have my pug, so.
Hey, I think you tweeted. Didn't you tweet something about the pug life?
I'm ready for the pug life now. He's a lot of fun. He's like 10 weeks old, so you just got to watch it. You don't step on it. You know?
Yeah, there you go. Awesome. Anything else?
No, that's it.
Okay, well, great. Well, thanks, guys, for listening to another episode of the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.